Welcome back. The Rhetoric Warriors podcast, a production of the not yet but soon to be founded Ethical Persuasion Institute. It's going to come to life here in California. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques. So here we are, some rhetoricians sowing the seeds of rhetorical wizardry out to the masses. Mixed a metaphor on purpose there for you, some wizard seeds. Although I guess they had those magic beans. Wizards probably have beans and seeds, right? I would think.
Why not? They can at any time we want to write them into the script.
So I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, late night comedy writer and stand-up, live here in Manhattan Beach, California, founder of Rhetoric Warriors and the EPI. My purpose on the podcast is to talk to comedians about their politics and their careers. I try to uncensor them, which I should do some more of. I've got some friends out here, so I should bring them on. I convert conservatives. If you have a conservative, send them to me. If you don't want to think differently, don't talk to me for an hour. And I talk to persuasion pros, social issue people, straight up rhetoricians, which brings me again to today and my buddy Dave Payne. We've been running our series of What Does Rhetoric Have to Say About That?
Right.
Through the big social issues. We've done three parter on war. We did guns, race, dystopia, and today we're going to the nice, gentle, you know, breezy, light rain topic of abortion.
Well, a couple of things. One is an observation that I found it a little more daunting to distinguish the rhetoric from the history and the politics as an object of interest, at least, although we've been inundated in it for many years. And secondly, I thought maybe we should probably begin with a disclaimer that two dudes talking about this topic may have an apology to make, or at least a gesture. However, I think we can turn it into a plus. With the poll that came out this week, that 28% of dads moved more Democratic as a result of the parents in general, but 20 the figure, and once again, I haven't analyzed the data, you know, the poll itself, but 28% of dads have moved toward Democrats as a result of the Supreme Court decision.
So this is saying that men do have a stake here. Children are more pro-abortion because they already have had children. They know what that's like.
Well, you know, I guess I had that kind of thought before it was quickly displaced with they are concerned about choice about these matters if they have daughters, especially being taken out of the family. It could well be coupled with, you know, the experiences of a wife. If some of the, you know, statistics are true about how many women have suffered rape in their lives, you know, the protection of the family is not a non-consequential thing for men. And so whether that's all good, it certainly in this case would help to explain why, you know, there may be some barbs here for the right wing as they've achieved this particular place.
Let's hope. Anyway. Hope there's some barbed wire.
We're two guys that would like to learn, and we would want to be edified by many women who've studied this more closely.
Well, I think next time maybe we should talk about cancel culture just as a phenomenon, just because the landmines really are, this is one of those issues that is so landminey because it is, you know, it's gender, it's reproductive rights, it's got so many things in it that you look at the complicated landscape that we're about to walk through and you should be intimidated to do rhetoric in this space.
But, you know, I did a, with some of this in mind, did a little quick Google search, and there's not a lot particular. There are a few things here and there about the rhetoric, word choice, language. But by and large, a handful of master's theses. Clearly, there are a few things in history, a few things in sociology that dovetail on this. So I found a lot of history, some politics, but not a lot that directly in terms of rhetorical studies. So there may be other reasons why, as a topic of interest to rhetoric per se. Anyway, I came up with a few things and happy to share them as we None of it's original. I'll disclaim that quickly.
Do you think that's because it's been settled law for so long that people didn't really go into it as a hot button contested issue the way that rhetoricians like to, you know, wiggle around in?
I don't know. I think maybe because it is a minefield in a number of different ways. I think there's some of the qualities of it as rhetoric, as a rhetorical contest, maybe contribute to the difficulty. I mean, you're either, you know, in the group or out of the group. That's one of the things that I've noted about it over the years is why, for instance, you may have banned it in your public speaking classrooms, because there is no resolution here. These two groups are really, the best I can say is they sort of illustrate the old canard of conservatives argue from principle and liberals argue from circumstances. It seems like almost a clear case of this, right? This is murder, categorically, right? Whereas all the reasons to keep abortion legal arise from the circumstances of the woman, the circumstances of the pregnancy, the circumstances that must be dealt with. So anyway, once again, indicating that rhetoric isn't what will ultimately resolve this. And that has kept it an edgy issue, I think. So that you're either in one camp or you're another camp, and it's all argument, perhaps, is the.
Yeah, it's one of those things, though, the rhetorical uses of abortion, you know, in politics and religion and, you know, in so many areas are so intense. I mean, this being a single topic issue for so many, you know, evangelical voters and conservative voters, that they brought it back up. You know, I'm not surprised that they brought it back up, but they made a dramatic move this time. And that's what you're kind of saying about now the liberals are going, oh, wait a minute, something has been changed. Power has come into this again, right, and made a change. And that's new.
Well, at the beginning of this sort of season, you know, when we knew 6 months ahead of time the Supreme Court was going to make this decision, which is an interesting phenomenon in and of itself. Oh, I heard some, you know, interviews, one of them with one of the original female lawyers that was involved with at the time of Roe v. Wade. And she said, you know, we never expected this to hold. And so when you mentioned that it's settled law, that kind of repeated shibboleth to get conservative Supreme Court justices out of actually answering the question honestly. Right. They all said it's settled law, which does not answer the question. At least according to this person, nobody expected it to hold as law. What was supposed to happen was that Congress was supposed to be able to pass a law, which ultimately they may be forced, and you know, if people vote correctly this time, will be successful in doing. So it could be sort of, you know, in limbo all along. And I think that if you look back at the checkered history, there are some interesting kinds of things. For instance, one is that people will tell you that the religious right got its start with Roe v. Wade as, oh my God, abortion is legal. And while there was certainly some activity at the time, there's plenty of chroniclers that say, not really. Especially not in the evangelical church. They didn't really jump on board until they were activated by all of these political preachers like Falwell as a way of kicking Jimmy Carter out of office, basically. And that was part of the Reagan Revolution that animated the evangelicals in 1979 against abortion. That it was never really a hard and fast rule. It was never really completely settled. Of course, you know, Catholics have been against it. But that's never been the winning doctrine in America. And the one Catholic in those races at the time, Ted Kennedy, was for free abortion that at least from what I read, Jimmy Carter was against, although a Baptist, was not against abortion, was against using federal funds. And Ted Kennedy primaried him, one of the reasons Carter lost. But he was in favor of, right? This was an issue within the Democrats themselves, and then picked up by the Reagan right. And since that time, right, the anti-abortion thing has been an animating and motivating thing from the religious right. So arguably that doesn't start the religious right at all.
That's funny. Well, when you, like I said, the issues like this fascinate me because there's so many sub-issues circulating around within this realm underneath this topic. And that one that you just mentioned, like taxes, like paying for abortions. So, you know, the things that come out eventually in these type of issues, you start to get to class where it's like, well, okay, so rich people can still go get abortions. They can fly somewhere and, you know, they have lots of options. This is basically a ban, you know, on the poor getting abortions. And that's a money issue. So, I mean, the money stuff starts to come back up around, and that's where like all these limitations, like we can go this far, but we can't make it federally funded. Or we can make it fairly funded, but only, you know, under these circumstances.
Right. And I think that is one of the, if you were to look at the rhetorical history, the way of these negotiations, right, and the language invented to stage these, like late term abortion or partial birth abortion. When is the fetus a person? If you look at the great variability, for instance, Germany has abortion, but only up to 12 weeks. Probably with a whole different set of cultural history and, you know, at some point you've got to figure this out. At one point, it was in the 60s, I think, maybe the 70s, but one of the politicians being able to use the heartbeat of the fetus, now made, you know, dramatic by ultrasound as that moment. So once again, that's demonstrably there, a living creature. And, you know, if you think just about, you know, what a great rhetorical device, you know, murdering babies.
That's a tough one to defend.
And rhetorically, that has kept, I think, the pro-choice movement, even in the phrase pro-choice, intimidated and on the defensive ever since. We can't say we're pro-abortion because, right, nobody wants to be in favor of that. So the actual characterization of the practice is never been properly languaged.
Right. And that's part of it, too, like dragging which venue you're going to leave it in. Are you going to leave it in the theater of, you know, the horror story, you know, and murder and, you know, that kind of criminal activity, that sort of, you know, anti-spirituality and the death of something that's innocent? Are you going to play over there in the mythology and the mythos of it? Or are you going to play over here in the logos of it, which is, hey, these are medical procedures, they're used worldwide, right. They're safe, this is why you need them. It's dragging people back and forth between those two rhetorical realms that I see a lot in this argument.
Right. The rhetoric itself does not bridge the shades of many shades of gray in the fact itself. And of course, I have to look at that and ask, okay, what's missing from this picture? And it seems to me to be the consistent thing, and I think history bears this out. So just to kind of punctuate what we just said, the murder of babies thing was never the frame of abortion as a practice or a concern until the kind of the late 70s movement. That itself was an invention and a phase. But the abortion issue itself goes back to the mid-1800s. And very much like, you know, our other bugaboo, it has almost a similar path of race. It wasn't about the baby or the baby as person, which are both rhetorical inventions of the last 40 years. It was about control of women. It was pretty murky until the 1850s, 1840s, when the AMA was formed and they decided they didn't want women taking care of other women. Right. Mm-hmm. This all of a sudden became something that dudes, elite dudes, must do. Right. And the anti-abortion movement began. And by 1900, there was in every state, apparently, an anti-abortion law as a result of that movement that did not include any exceptions for the condition of our life of the female. So,
well, it is wrapped up right in that packet of abolition and, you know, temperance movement and women's suffrage and all that stuff. Like, you couldn't have women's suffrage unless you had some way of improving women's sexuality and control of their own bodies and all that kind of stuff. So you just
see all that has been threatening all along. Right. And so one thing I note about all of these different rhetorical constructions of say the, you know, in my life of the last 40 years from the 70s on, when it appeared to me as a rhetorical scholar of a set of issues. The character and agency and situation of the woman really is what's missing. And of course, that gives some credence here to what our current feminists and women are saying. This is about me having power and agency to control my own body, right? That's not just an excuse. That really is kind of the thrust of the rhetoric. The fetus has got all these rights, and the men in the medical community has all of these rights.
I think that is the central rail on that side of the argument, right? That women determine what happens with women's bodies.
Right.
Why do
men? But that is so easily dismissed by the ideology of the other side, right?
But it's one of those things that maybe if you're looking, you know, for, again, I tend to drive this stuff towards rhetorical advice. If we were the advisory council, let's strengthen that one. Let's get people to accept that women are the only ones in charge of women. Maybe you've heard this in sort of, you know, comedy and absurdism about, well, why do men even get to vote on this? Why is this something that men are involved in this decision at all? Which if you drove really hard, maybe you could get some more rhetorical traction for that logic. Like, there's no way men should be making this decision for female bodies.
Yet, I mean, isn't that sort of a stereotypic feminist sort of thing that we can bundle it up with the dismissal of women's voices, part and parcel. So, you know, that at least that doesn't seem to have much traction or enough traction, at least, in a patriarchal society.
Darn patriarchs again. It's the,
there you go.
I try to make a joke, as I've stopped doing for most of my existence, in gender, because it's just too minefieldy, even if it's a good joke. Like, I was talking to somebody who had she said her degree was in women's studies. And I'm like, one thing I do notice, you call it women's studies, but it definitely does a lot of time studying men too. Like, you've got a good, clear villain in the patriarchy, and that's very useful in that discussion. And I wasn't trying to downplay women, you know, feminism or the women's studies. I was just kind of making a joke, and that doesn't really work in that space.
Well, a lot of them have switched to women and gender studies, and there are a lot of men that are now teaching in those departments, I think.
Well, and it gets fascinating when you look at the fluidity of all these concepts, right? So gender fluidity, sexuality fluidity. But what about, like, when you look at abortion, life fluidity? Because that's really what this is. It's like, when does life begin? Do we have the right to end it before it's fully formatted? You know, like, there's, or is it that much sanctity, even though there's 7.5 billion of us? What is the holiness of the life that, like, even the reincarnation spirituality versus the Christian one life and you go to heaven? Like, if you're interrupting a baby or a fetus on its way, it just gets reincarnated somewhere else in other spiritualities, right? You don't destroy that spirit.
Well, if nothing else, it illustrates the inadequacy of law to navigate these kinds of dimensions of human relations. I mean, I think that struggle over when does life begin, this trying to compromise in some fashion, and that compromise never being adequate to the absolutism of the rhetoric. That's the thing. Rhetoric will keep both camps seething, but won't find the bridging dialectic, right?
Yeah, but maybe we jump in there again. That's one of those things that we can clean up, add some clarity to, or get some rhetorical traction in this idea of, like, well, when does life begin? Are you telling me, like, that life begins then at the instant that the sperm, like, gets within a centimeter of the egg, like, it's, or, you know, it's halfway through the line?
Well, there are people representing that point of view, that God is there, and even if it's a rape, God is there making that happen. A birth is a divinely inspired moment.
It's also
so if you accept this divine chain of definitions, right? And so that, you know, people are contemporarily making that opinion. And then, of course, the, you know, and it was a nice halfway house to say, when the fetus can survive outside the womb, then it, right, then, yeah, then let it outside the womb.
Right. There we have a scientific logic.
Yeah.
That people go, okay, we can hold on to that one and get enough peace in the boiling camps that we found a middle ground.
Right. But I think it is worth once again repeating that this absolute, even though the rhetoric is absolutist, is a fairly recent absolutism in the difficulty of us as a society to confront this issue and to provide adequate language for characterizing it. And once again, the thing that seems to get lost here is, you know, I mean, look at Donald Trump couldn't talk about anything else but abortion like his first couple of months in office. The baby is ripped from the womb.
Yeah.
Once again, where's the woman in this picture? That's what's happening here in terms of her, mindful contemplation of what is right. That narrative is completely displaced by the violence. And once again, the fetus is rhetorically constructed as person. Just like we can make a corporation a person if we keep trying hard enough, I guess.
Well, and if we wander over again to the story, the narrativity of it again, like the right has its narrativity, the left narrativity about this, you see a lot of dystopian narrativity where the woman is basically taken, agency completely taken away and becomes a uterus, you know, a baby Hauser with
Handmaid's Tale.
And all that. And there's a lot of science fiction like that.
Sure. You know?
But it, like I've seen, like when this first happened, oh my God, the use of Handmaid's Tale as a rhetorical toolbox, like the women protesting in front of the Supreme Court houses in the Handmaid's outfits, you know, just walking up and down on the sidewalk, things like that. It's like, well, at least they've been given some rhetorical narrativity to work with.
Right. And, you know, it is kind of spooky how things are shaking out, that if you're trying to, find some sort of merger between a theocracy and a tyrannical rule by males, it's about power. And that is part of, you know, one of the other echoes before we get too far off of that theme. One of the echoes from also the 1900s that is around today, it seems to me, that's what's being masked by a lot of this rhetoric is the race issue, that the genuine concern here is that abortion's going to, and I guess numerically has been part and product of keeping the white birth rate completely down. And of course, even the flip side, I guess, in Clarence Thomas's opinion, he sees this as genocide of black babies too. So there is that concern. And that definitely was a concern of the late 1800s, that, a parallel with the Reconstruction, the failure of Reconstruction and the clamping down of racial control is this issue about we have to control women too. We have to control reproduction.
So it all goes back to white male anxiety about losing power?
I would say that's a very productive rhetorical thread to say what's being masked in all of this rhetoric. I mean, the French feminists of the late 60s said, you know, I guess, I can't remember whether it was Sassou or Irigaray that said, you know, basically if we look at birth, once the man has provided the seed, he's irrelevant to anything else. So when he comes back and reinvades the family and creates it as property, right? This is about power and control. So, you know, there is that possibility.
Reinvades the family. I like that.
that could be my own characterization.
Yeah, I like it. That's a good image. I'm going to break back.
Certainly, the fatherly intrusions as a veteran dad often are treated that way. You're invading us again.
When I think of this sort of in city rural also, right? I mean, the cities being these sexual Sodom and Gomorrahs where you can have abortions and you can just have as much sex as you want. And the abortions are always there. And if you look like the 70s movies, sexuality for women, you know, all the women were, you know, getting abortions all the time. And and that played out in that sort of city rhetoric that the rural population.
Sure. I mean, there is a biblical, the city is sin and get out of her, my people, right? So that this is a set of urban immoral practices that.
When I think of
biblical, why else would they be after contraception too? I mean,
right. That's not
really Republican men. Really? This is what you want?
Well, when the realities come crashing down, they're not having sex anyway. So I guess they're being rejected right and left anyway. So
some evidence to the contrary.
When I think about this, some big rhetorical forces, like you were saying, their legal opinions were iffy. It was a middle ground that you could sell, but it wasn't particularly legally strong. There were lots of flaws in it. But the right hates, it's two things. They hate a middle ground, and they see a middle ground as an opportunity. So what they're doing right now is going back and yanking things out of the middle ground, right? That's become sort of, it seems like, with the recent extremist moves in the right's rhetoric has been to go, well, where are the settled things that we can create, you know, rage about by just ripping it back out of the compromise?
Well, I mean, once again, that's why I think history and politics are maybe more interesting in a lot of ways than the rhetoric per se that is used, because it's kind of out there and in your face, right? And we could talk about all the different techniques that so quickly became cliche as that movement took hold. Pictures, jars with fetuses, you know, being passed in my classroom, stuff like this, where, you know, I don't know. So I'm trying to remember as one rhetorical watermark when we decided to ban abortion from our speech classrooms because
is that
stuff, right? But it had to do with that extremism and emotionality. So, well, just noting that about the rhetoric, but back to, you know, the reason why I think animating the evangelicals in America toward the right as a political phenomenon is what elected Reagan and is what has been necessary to electing every Republican since. And that's the only possible way to explain why Trump would be on board of that. God knows how many abortions he might have paid for, right? I don't believe it has anything to do with moral commitment, but an absolute certainty that base must be animated and fed and kept in the Republican Party for them to win elections. So that has that political history. So once again, there, I guess back to your point, and I'm sorry if I obscured that. Back to your point, is keeping it extreme and irresolved are both politically useful things.
Yeah.
In other words, it's a problem you don't want to solve.
Right.
Really.
Like, it's fine to keep, like, the more royal, the better. Like, that is what activates, it's what gives one side psychic energy. And if you even think about the way it ties back into the biological drives of parenting, keep that baby alive, protect the family, you know, all these things that you are basically programmed into conservative thinking, you know, as a sort of power cell of it, that it gets back into all of that stuff. And they literally see, you can see it in the rhetoric, that they're defending, you know, the most vulnerable life on the planet. And it just has all sorts of biological ties that end up sort of, you know, underpinning their religion and everything else.
Right. Well, but also, you know, the other face of that, I think all of those fleas are on that dog. But if you don't have something of that kind of absolutism and catastrophic, you know, importance, the evangelical right is not going to be terribly politicized. They've got their own bigger spiritual fish to fry. And that was, you know, that is the case. That is sort of the default condition of the religious. It's just, they're not getting their sustenance through political action until animated in these ways. So once again, it is this kind of rhetorical issue. I guess what maybe we're saying is it's this kind of issue because it was made to be this kind of issue.
Right. Well, in the horror
film. And once again, the arguments of rationality or science or legal dimensions of how do we conduct civil society and solve this problem? How do we, give women the autonomy and let them make these decisions? However, culturally restrained we are about that movement, just simply have no vitality. So it's going to have to just be either solved in the law and respected. But as we're discovering right now, that may not be a final solution to many of these issues. One has to wonder, okay, let's say that the Democrats win the elections. They do pass a nationwide law making abortion, the law of the land. What happens then? Yeah, with the rhetorical.
Like you talk about the way it animates people, the way it agitates, the way it creates these psychic and pathos triggers in people, the horror filming of this issue from one side of, like you said, the jars in LA. I remember when I lived here back in the late 90s, they were driving around big, huge billboards on the highways of abortions. And you were stuck next to them because it was LA traffic. So you might have been stuck around one of these billboards for miles. And on the other side, the lesser horror filming, I think it's still a lesser rhetoric of women dead from back alley abortions and the black and white images and things like that they're pulling up. But it's
right.
You almost have
and that's to. That's part of the intimidation of the other side, is that to even counter this rhetoric, they are forced into that lexicon of botched abortions, right? Desperate women, raped women, which is the exceptional case, rather than really trying to capture the essence.
Right, but they started this, and you see this matching rhetorics. Like you see the intensity, like you said, the vitality of the horror filming of the fetus, and then over here, I've seen it a lot in the time since the decision about Roe v. Wade. Like the 10-year-old who got, pregnant and had to have an abortion in Indiana. The woman required to, I think it's going on right now in Texas, supposedly whose baby doesn't have a skull completely formed and is being required to carry this baby to term, even though it's not viable. And so you do get this sort of very visceral, biological, horror filming rhetoric on both sides. Now, what does that do? Rhetorically, does that get traction? Does that actually get people animated enough to vote about this? I'm not sure.
Well, what those kinds of examples, single emotional examples do is they bolster and activate the commitment to one side. In other words, you're speaking to your own choir in both cases. And in order to survive as humans, right, cognitive dissonance tells us we'll just simply downplay that from the other side. I'm not going to think about that 10-year-old. That's a single case. That's, they're probably lying about it, right?
It's right.
The latest way of coping with that. Think about it. So we'll counter that with a statistic that, gee, in the last 20 years, how many babies have been murdered? Once again, they intensify. It's, it's back with the old mothers against drunk driving. My story of my son or my child, right, is, make the people who already agree with me weep, but the other side is simply just not going to deal with that and counter it with their own.
Right. Hey, I'm going to pause for just a second because I'm getting a garbage truck. It's going to be like 4 feet away. Hold on.
Okay.
So you're making the point that doesn't actually cull the herd from the other side. Like using these,
it doesn't change minds. It intensifies those who already agree with you.
I wonder, if we lay out all the planks of argument, like all the way through, narrativity and the pathos of it and the logos. We're like, here are all the rhetorical tools, the assets that you can use. Like cognitive dissonance is one way to avoid that, right? Or to deny the validity of your argument, your images. But I think on the other side, with the visceralness of those images about babies and fetuses being babies, like that does actual work, even on liberals, it seems like. Like liberals don't feel good about abortion. Like there's no way.
Once again, I guess what I meant by this is you store that somewhere while you focus on the, this is to me fascinating. You have to come up with how do people sort of walk around? What is the nature of rhetorical experience? And it could well be because these are equal and opposite and almost irresolvable tensions and languages that are out there competing. That like, you know, religion itself for many people, are religion and science. You know, you have these kinds of hybrid things. Most people walk around and for 100 years or so have walked around with both evolution and creation as origin stories. They simply sometimes try to reconcile them in strange sorts of ways. But mostly they just live with them, and one of them can be activated at one time and another at another time. And it could well be that there is that same kind of schizoid nature to abortion as a result of the rhetorical experience of these of this irresolvable conflict. So that, yeah, you do, your brain has been populated with these images. You have been acted upon with the idea that, and the reality that an abortion takes something that looks very much like a human baby and ends its life. Well, with all the kind of embellishments that goes along with that.
Something I like something that looks very much like a human baby. That really gets at the core of it, though, right? I mean, the simplicity.
Well, I remember there was this phase of arguing, well, it's not an avocado, therefore it is a human, right? There was actually that moment in the argumentative biopsy of this thing.
Yeah, and the other thing is that there are two mega issues here that almost nobody, I think, would argue against rhetorically. One, killing babies is wrong, and telling or controlling women is wrong. Now, there's more leeway in the second one, as you've pointed out, that men want to control women for many reasons. But the first one, I think killing babies is a caveat across the board, is you're going to get almost 100% agreement on that one.
Sure, sure.
So if you can establish that word, like it's a definitional war, right? If you can establish the word baby, then you've gotten a lot of traction in this issue.
Well, yeah, I think if we were to kind of divide this up into rhetorical epochs, making the fetus a person would be probably the most significant of the last 40 years. If it were a football game, you got 50 yards and within field goal position with that one, right? Yeah, for want of any kind of better metaphor.
As I used to say, life begins when you buy somebody a drink at the bar. How far are we going to move life? Life is now very mobilized. Like it's been very fluid, that definition. And that's part of the problem, right? I think for the left is how do you reattach that definition to where it was before of viability outside a female?
Well, I guess once again, I want to just kind of keep beating the same drum, which is that what's missing in that characterization of the conflict is that women's autonomy versus baby murder is that, the syllogism there is, okay, now we have moms murdering their own babies. And that's the way women are being treated. So they wind up double losers in this. And how do you compete with that sort of inference? You talked about, advice, and one of the things that has been going on apparently, and what, this is all just my reading, Simone de Beauvoir, since that time, of having women tell their stories of having an abortion, and through the 70s, lots of prominent women sharing their narrative, their own experience. These were not mothers murdering babies, right? These were women in very difficult circumstances making the best choices they could. So there's only one way that, at least that is one possible way of expanding the rhetorical field rather than contracting to these, impossible.
And draining the pathos out of it is another play for the left, right? To normalize abortions, that this is a medical procedure.
That's been one way, yeah. That the sciencey language has certainly tried to do that. Fortunately, unfortunately, maybe, whatever I want to say there, science has not been particularly effective. We find in any number of issues, talking about things science-y doesn't change people's, you know. I think in terms of your ethical orientation here, that's it, because we do orient to these things not scientifically, but ethically. And so, just as we orientate towards sex, sexuality, with romance and all these other primitive attachments, just being sciencey about it, it runs counter to the human nature of it. So,
yeah, I don't think science has enough rhetorical potential to do a lot in this. It seems to fall pretty flat.
But well, go ahead.
Just the basic communication of it, like you said, the storytelling, the normalizing of it, like, hey, this isn't always a massive dramatic event. It's not always the worst part of a woman's life. Sometimes it's just, hey, I need to delay being a mother until a certain amount of time. And maybe building up some really much stronger normalized ways of talking about it so that it doesn't become this supernatural hyped up event. Maybe that's part of the thing that you can do.
Sure, and I think that's probably right, and probably the thing that is suppressed because it has been attached with shame, is that this is a truth that many women are walking around with but can't really tell without some risk to their family or to their friend, their social network or whatever. And so, it's what we found about many of these conservative advocates, certainly in the gay transformations of the last 20 years or so. I'm hard and fast doctrinaire about this until it happens to me, right? Until my son comes home and says, I'm gay and I need for you to continue to love me. And all of a sudden, that maybe there needs to be more documentation about the normality of abortion within the American family. And once again, I think that the blinders on that possibility, you get back to what you were saying about class, that rich white people can afford to keep that a family secret, and something we overlook as we march on to our careers and our other families, whatever. The way that poor are experiencing that, they just remain victims and don't have that kind of redemptive trajectory for it. So, I think it gets shrouded once again with race and class.
Yeah. And I think going back to, like, I always like to pull things back to pop culture, like the filmic abortions, you think The Godfather. Remember when she finally said, Michael, I had an abortion. Right. And he could never forgive me because it is the worst thing a human being could ever do. And, you know, like, to take that moment, which is really, like you said, a fairly normal thing in human experience. There's miscarriages, there's all these things that stop birth progressions. It's not an unnormal, abnormal event. It's very familiar to most people. But to raise it up into some type of good, evil, to bring it up into that, and suddenly it's got all this energy in it, politically, religiously, all these things. It's maybe
of course we were getting an anatomy of a hyper sexist Catholic culture and tradition of once again, it's important that this is a boy child and that it perpetuates some sort of ancient Sicilian contract, right? So. All of those things are present in that moment and revealed in that moment too.
Yeah, but it's fascinating that becomes the thing. Like when you look at China and the one child policy and how many abortions, you know, occurred in that society.
Murder of female children.
And right.
It wasn't just abortion. Our female children that were left because the parents didn't want to get rid of it, left on the doorstep somewhere, and many sent to the United States, or at least there were organizations bringing to the United States.
So maybe that's the move. It's not just to normalize abortions, it's to devalue babies.
Well, I think there is, as there is that indirect route to talk about the need for population control.
I mean, that is a rhetorical move that you can take here. As we overvalue human life because it's been used as a rhetorical tool, especially around babies for these.
But once, so look at the more honest, as we talked about, the more honest address at that level is, oh, we need more white babies or we're going to be put down as a minority.
Well, that's why I make a point a lot of times with people that modern rhetoric and political rhetoric leaves out the adjective. Like reinstate the adjective in this argument. And that would be, you know, it's wrong to kill white babies. And somebody said that. Who was that politician that had a slip of the tongue that they're out there killing white babies very early in this? And when you add back the proper adjective, you start to actually focus the issue, right? It's like, it's a really nice little rhetorical tool to just drop that adjective back in, like, you know, fascist or, you know, all these different things that will suddenly focus it because you've completely defined this term instead of the generic of the term.
Oh, I, as an aside, I'm reeling day to day watching the news at how that language of tyranny, fascism, dictatorship is accused from both sides equally, right? The raiding of Mar-a-Lago being evidence that we've achieved a fascist state. Rudy Giuliani saying today, because he was hauled in to testify, we're losing democracy. So both sides are both claiming, and this was just on the news tonight, that this next election will decide whether we're going to be, you know, a democracy or, you know, anyway.
Well, so that's a weird.
We have so completely bifurcated the consensual reality that now both sides can occupy the same language forms.
But don't you think ultimately that's the right's autonomic use of, you know, stealing everything from the other side and reusing it, that appropriation dictate, where they suddenly, like, you see, like, it grow up really strongly on the left and the right just grabs it. They start with Tucker Carlson. He reuses the same language, but just changes out the heroes and the villains. I see it.
I don't know that it's that, you know, that might be just kind of another liberal smugness to say, well, gee, they're just second order deriving that from this is 1984. And then you hear some people say, this is 1980.
Because it's in Putin's handbook of how to do propaganda, to appropriate whatever the other side and to accuse them of doing what they just accused you of.
That's certainly a phenomenon that's going on. That's certainly a phenomenon. But I think it's just how flimsy these definitions and their historical context are. That's just like Hitler. That's just like Stalin. You know, it's just an easy. It's not difficult to appropriate.
Well, and it also shows how thin our reserves are of authoritarian political rhetoric in this country. We haven't had to deal with this. It's never really ascended here. So we're going all the way back to the 40s Germany to try to grab some terminology and some imagery that will have enough potency now. Most of the country.
Well, it's just that Hitler and Nazis, you know, and the attendant surviving images, which have been reenacted in film over and over and over and over again, and political rhetoric, are just this available, you know, hermeneutic of evil. So if you want to make sure something is evil, you can automatically attach these things to them. But it's more and more, you know, replete with, oh, these are the FBI stormtroopers. These are, you know. And of course, you know, like all of the more intellectual side of these things, we want to say, well, we're the right ones and we have the right use of those terms. I think in the great, you know, the great babble out there, that doesn't really matter much, right? And that the more interesting thing is that they're both offset, equal and opposite. And maybe that is, as you say, the purpose. This just nullifies that entire.
It does. And I think it constantly, the right is really good at constantly appropriating and nullifying the rhetorical resources.
That occurs to us that way. Although I remember, you know, in this last election, the last presidential election, and I was tuned into some radio station and some call in, obviously, geezer, rural geezer. Joe Biden's going to be the biggest dictator this country's ever known. And you think, how can my reality be so topsy-turvy and changed into, you know, that this person is living in an equal and opposite sort of schismosis. that is the frame that we're carrying into. Once again, how does rhetoric function in that kind of a echo chamber? Is really the difficulty. It certainly can't You know, what take your own definition of rhetoric, whatever happy one has, try to plug in. How does it address, you know, misunderstandings and their remedy? How does it address the peaceful identification? Whatever rhetoric is supposed to be doing to make this a more functional planet, it is not going to work very well in that environment.
Right, and that's why I'm always fascinated with taking all this rhetorical training and toolkits and actually getting into conversations with the right. Because then, like, if you approach it without hitting all the landmines and all the triggers, the question becomes, what can you leave behind? What can you do in that conversation that can cull that herd? Because talking to your own herd, this idea that we have an unlimited supply of unregistered voters who will be Democrat, versus we need to learn how to go into the red herd, and do good work. Like, it's, you can't just yell, you can't just argue, you can't just do these things. Like, there's clearly still rhetorical potential even in the craziest mind like that. Because you mentioned earlier the praxis of living through a child that's gay or transitions or things like that causes fundamental change. Now, maybe it's just oriented mostly around that relationship. They don't extrapolate to the bigger population and become that sort of compassionate entity. But I've seen it work many times, that praxis, one-on-one praxis like that can create change, even in a disordered mind.
Sure. And once again, just, you know, embodied experience that most people are pretty tolerant and friendly and empathetic with each other, human to human. But that, once again, we're all looking through this through the deflection of our own media, and that's an abstraction, right? So yeah, let's get people. And what are we saying about these families that sort of say, when they have to deal with the complexity of these issues and the pain of an individual that they love, revising these ideological orientations? So once again, most people are playing these out in big rhetorical dramas where there are no consequences. They aren't just movies. And that reorienting people toward experience, while on the other side, women sharing their own experiences to try to once again repopulate the symbolic field here with experience-driven realities. And I think that's the one thing that we have to say. You know, these are irrealities that are easily sustained in this kind of media environment. We're not, you know, we're sitting inside watching TV and watching clowns on TV every night instead of actually relating to each other. I will say that in some of these politics, at least my own experience, has become so difficult to talk to family members or whatever, that it just gets folded into a new layer of conflict and struggle for autonomy rather than building a bridge to resolution.
Well, but the challenge, I think that's great. I think that's a great way to summarize it. I think that, to me, the phenomenon of talking into absorbed script is the question, because it's not dialogue. It's not human communication. It's how do you dislodge, or how do you deal with absorbed script? Because they're no longer processing that script. It's just coming in and coming out. And I know that oversimplifies it, but that's what I keep running into. Like, I've talked about this guy at the gym many times, older dude who just bloviates in the jacuzzi. And it's just a flow of what was on Fox the night before. And sometimes I don't want to get involved because I don't want to do my persuasion in the jacuzzi at the gym when I'm trying to avoid all humans. But I want to just pluck one of them out, just pluck one thing out and say, let's make that more real. Let's take that out of script world and let's process it a little bit together. What do you think? And see if he would.
Yeah, you know, do people deal with difficult situations, existential situations, with those little shards of reality? Or do they prefer, you know, cutting those into huge slabs of drama? I think one thing you have to get at is that these are just not rote, mindless scripts. This person is achieving some kind of ego identity and pathetic power out of being able to do the bloviation in those societies. I mean, really, yeah, somebody should just tell him to shut up. it's really about power. Just shut up. You shouldn't be saying this stuff in my jacuzzi, but at any rate.
Jacuzzi, hey, free jacuzzi space. Come on now. This is...
it shouldn't come to just who's biggest, who's more muscular
than the jacuzzi.
But what one wonders. But at any rate, once again, so it's not just enough to say, gee, these people are parroting opposite scripts. They're living in and through that language, and they're achieving some kind of social being that way. Just as Tucker Carlson is as well, or like Alex Jones or any of these people, they're earning money. They're putting bread on the table. They're being somebody. They don't have to believe this crap, but you know, I think we have to, as scholars, understand, you know, the psychology of this. What is the kind of participation this is giving this guy? I know we've touched on it in our other talks when we talked about propaganda, but to me, the phrase in the current, doing my own research, I did my own, I'm an active participant, and so I came up with this truth somehow, no matter how derivative and parroting it must sound. And usually what doing my own research means, I looked at four different websites that drew the same lie from the same source and echoed it, but I am somehow part of that discovery, mm-hmm. right, in trying to deal with this difficult question. And then you hear the chant on the other side, do your own research. Well, anyway. So there is, dramatism doesn't just mean there is a script out there. It also means we enact it and we embody that script in the way we do social life. And what things are being nurtured that way, and how might they be nurtured some other way? If we really wanted to doctor culture, I think creating more space of interaction here, whether it be the jacuzzi or some other. People walking around with rifles now, we've kind of let it go a bit far.
Yeah, well, it's like you said, the identification, consubstantiality with the drama itself, that it then has to be lived. And somebody made a point on Twitter the other day that, you know, we keep acting like it's normal that a guy just walked into the CIA office in Cincinnati with a gun, a guy, you know, charged the barricade in DC with a gun. Both of them saw themselves as the trigger point of launching the new civil war. Like they would become the martyr that was the, you know, match that led all of this, because that story dramatism is so strong. And even on the left, I see this now where like they take the right, as you've said, and turn them into this dramatic villain, and therefore they don't know how to talk to them. I see it, my daughter, my young millennial daughter, who can't talk to villains because they're so intense for her. You know, when somebody's sexist or transist or genderist or whatever she finds, it's like it just locks her up. And I'm like, no, you can't be pulled that deeply into the drama or you become an ineffective rhetorician. So that's, to me, eventually, it's what rhetoric offers, is the ability to stay zen with this, see it as a game of, you know, it's a game of words, and make good choices about how you're going
to
affect
them. But your ability to even try to enact transcendence there in some fashion depends on you and your power and your location. I mean, you know, you're a strong personality with a lot of education and a lot of skills. Yeah, I suppose we should be trying to provide people a certain amount of armor, but not everybody can be gifted with the kind of the interventional qualities.
Well, and it's one of those things that's hard because so much of education now has been consumptionized. Everyone needs it in packets. They don't have time to absorb. They need a quick set of answers. And I work with businesses all the time that want this from me. But then on the other hand, you look at a complicated issue like abortion that's super hypercharged with, like you said, stories and emotions and all these things that have been dumped into it. And you're like, well, people need some more sophisticated skill to do some decent work in there. How do you get that to them in a way that they become adept with it? So that it doesn't just fail them in the moment, which is what so often happens when I see people try to do some work with extreme family members and things like that. They just break and it becomes a blow up again because they can't zen their way through it.
Well, I do think, to speak on behalf of your kids and mine and others, that being the one to just let it pass and not generate conflict, I mean, it's hard to know what else to do, I think, for many people. And this does unravel back to, uncivil public spaces, that how we have constructed, so if you think, what could you do in a classroom? Well, but maintenance of order in any classroom now is a very fragile thing. And so what we've tried to do is create these public spaces where the people of each of these stripes can, or many stripes can get along and stay focused on reading and writing and arithmetic. And then, of course, the whole legislative movement to control what teachers are saying and the crisis that's yielding right now. Our governor here is saying policemen should take up the slack in terms of with these missing teachers.
What an amazing thought. That is an amazing connection.
Why not the Walmart greeters? What are they doing? They work.
Bro, let the old people teach.
They're exactly. That's why I say Walmart greeters would be better than the cops, for crying out loud.
That's who you want, like in a dealing with adolescents and things like that, as a cop.
Because sure, that'll clear it up. They don't have any political axes to grind, do they? Yeah. You want to try to fly to some sort of place outside the country and say, okay, what sounds like a fascist state to you? I guess the good thing about having cops there is they would already be armed in case somebody
came in wanting to perform.
We wouldn't have to wait for the cops to get into the classroom at Uvalde. He would already be there.
Yeah. Well, there are these
ridiculous, absurd tunnels on this right now, as we are kind of at a terrible loggerhead.
So, do we go back as rhetoricians to, hey, if we could recarve out civil space and all stay in there and talk without the explosiveness that politics is now sort of throwing into every conversation, we can still do good work with each other. I mean, is that the ultimate goal, to reinstate the power of civility?
I think that might be a good language for it. I think the serious talk among people like yourself and that what does that require I think I like your name change to ethical persuasion here. Let's start with the reality that these are ethical dimensions to sorting through individual and public life, and we got to figure out ethical ways of being in the world that allow other people to do that as well. So maybe it's just a need for some greater imagining rather than leaving it up to these giant slabs of rhetoric that really are only designed, once again, all they really do is get a certain number of people to the polls. I mean, it is occurring in a political context. And so maybe, we are at also an interesting moment, it seems to me, where both sides are saying, gee, you've got to become political or else the world's going to crumble. Maybe, and our young people and sometimes minorities are often want to live in the world unpolitically. That is a greater ethical being for them. Your daughter doesn't want to go around arguing with some doofus about things that she's already made up her mind about. She wants to live in a world where she doesn't have to do that, and there's something wonderful about that, right? And so I think part of the human relations, human potentials movement of the past was, can we quit doing that? and find the person behind that language. I don't know, I'm retreating to that kind of idealism only because we also are kind of in a bizarre position where being apolitical is not, any longer an ethical choice. And once again, that's part of the dysfunction of the political system. Most people don't really want to pay any attention to this till they have to go into the voting booth and decide. And when they do, they make it up on the basis of you know, the last 2 weeks of the drama. So,
yeah, I think of the, again, when Trump arrives into this scene, and even before that, when Gingrich and the Contract with America, these civil dominated politics, the civility of politics, the etiquette within American politics, which has always sort of been there. You can see it in Biden. You know, Biden, even when Manchin finally, whatever he needed to sign the bill, Biden had a little bit, he can swallow a lot because he's been in the Senate for so long and he knows how these things work, that eventually you just can't react in the moment all the time. And that, to me, that sort of gentleman or sort of elderly politician that gets to the point where he knows there's process here. And sometimes it's a corruptedness acceptance and knows he can, like the Mitch McConnells, but sometimes it's like a Biden who's like a statesman. He's like, yeah, just, this is going to take real work over time. It's going to have a lot of failure and a lot of heartbreak in it. And eventually you're going to get somewhere. And
yeah, I noticed that when he signed the bill, Manchin was standing there, and he turned to him and gave him the pen that he signed it with, and shook his hand.
Yeah,
wow, that's walking the walk, you know. The amount of legislation, you know, rather than just simply destruction, I think we need to, you know, we've got to address those issues. That I watch a little Morning Joe every now and then because his screeds are so good, but. The last couple of mornings, he's talking to one of his Republican stronghold guys in who says the American government can be replaced, which I think is also sort of the Arizona mantra these days. And, I wanted to be able to say, ask him what he plans to replace it with.
Right.
Which did not occur to Joe to say, sadly. What do you have in mind is going to be around here next? Right. But clearly, one side here is really only about destroying the other side. So I think our ethical point of view can start there.
The question becomes, and I've thought about this a lot, the question becomes, when all of their political efficacy and political energy is built on throwing dynamite into the room, which is the entire Trump phenomenon, period. That's what the man does. And he destroys institutions and then, you know, sort of like breaking up a company and then siphons off the power here and there and hands it out and sells it. So how do you stop them from throwing this rhetorical dynamite into civil spaces? Maybe, you know, that becomes the dominant issue for reconstructing democracy and public discourse so it doesn't have these hackable vulnerabilities that the right has made its living on, essentially. Yeah, let's blow it up and ruin the process, and we can grab some power while it's all simple.
Well, the footprints of this go, you know, deep, but back to the Tea Party kind of mentality of they were so angry that we bailed out, right, the government, the economy, the corporation, and that is the seed stock of Trumpism, is that anger. And I've confronted Trumpers with this, and the smarter ones will agree with me quickly. That's when it really got, we should have let it die. But once again, they have this kind of naive, a phoenix-like idea of what would be taking root in its place.
Right. Well, that's the logical.
Real depression is a pretty ugly thing.
There's no progression of logical thought. It's angry enough to use unethical practices to stop whatever's going on. But beyond that, it doesn't have a rhetorical or political agenda. It just knows how to stop things. Like, hey, bunch of semis, show up. We're going to stop this. And you're like, okay, well, what's next? It doesn't matter. We're just going to stop it. We're going to stop the vote.
Well, one looks at the places across the globe where they have destroyed the government, and it's not terribly encouraging. The other kind of meme, I know we've drifted a little bit here, but in facing climate change, facing all the discord, we need a strong man. Okay, let's concede all of those arguments. We need a strong man. Trump's really, that clown is really the guy think is going to be able to do? I mean, the rest of the world's laughing at this ass. He can't, you know, walk across the room without breaking some sort of law. I mean, what You know, is that really Steve Bannon, the guy you had in mind?
Are you leading with your best? Is that the best you got, guys?
So he's just there. He is the technique of destroying the guy, apparently.
Well, he's always been that. He destroys. That's his. He gets in and becomes.
But he's not even the strong man that can. He's not what replaces it, I guess, is my point of view. What do you think is coming next? And in each and every case, it is me, Ron DeSantis, me, right? Abbott. I'm what replaces this. Take a good look. I don't see any real candidates for, American Putinhood. And
scary. Well, any last?
I'll take Biden. Thank you.
Any last words on abortion? Like, fix it for.
Well, I don't know. I learned from the conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, I did too. I think a lot of that stuff where you're talking about, the drama of it and sort of getting us back to some kind of logic-based discourse or civil-based discourse, I think is useful.
It is around and prominent and on our minds because it has been a wedge issue. It has forced the cleavage. And I do think that it is a mask for other agendas, just as I think our current culture war is a mask for racial tension and is a Trojan horse that's smuggling that, irrepeatably back into our lives. That's at least one conclusion to watch is that it's got all these entailments.
Abortion is a Trojan horse. Double metaphor for you.
There you go.
It's like a Russian nesting doll.
Well, that was certainly unintentional.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for jumping on. We will circle back around and we'll pick up some other issue and do our rhetoric thing on it. Hit the social issue with the rhetorical pinata stick and see what breaks open. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Thanks for hopping in. Get out there and persuade people. It's kind of fun. It's necessary. Do it.